Hi, everybody. My name is Franny, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 7th, 1970, and my home group is the South Bay Survivors. So that means that I got 36 years of sobriety. That's pretty good. Actually, I was younger than that when I got sober, so that means it's more in my life sober than where I was before. Drunk, loaded, neurotic, unhappy, stealing, lying, cheating, all that stuff we don't want to talk about. You know, it's really interesting. When you've got a speaker, this is what I've noticed, and you can agree or disagree with me out in the parking lot after the meeting, but you won't win. But I will tell you that I have noticed that the longer a guy is sober, the better his story gets. I have also noticed that the longer a woman is sober, sometimes her story gets really boring. And I couldn't figure out what it was for a while, you know, and then finally I realized that what happened for a lot of women, they come in here, they get sober, and then when they tell their story, they've become ladies. So they're simply not going to discuss what forced them to bring their sick, sorry selves in here in the first place. They used to do it, now they won't even talk about it, you know. So my sponsor made me promise that I wouldn't start getting involved in looking good and leaving stuff out, because I've got that kind of story. So anyway, I come out of an Irish CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic, New York City, grandparents were all drunks, both parents were drunks. Nobody knew my mother was a drunk until after my father died, because you simply don't see the moon when the sun's out. And he was the kind of guy that would make anybody look sober if you put them next to him. You know, he was just that kind of a guy. And he was a wonderful man when he wasn't drinking, which was seldom. But he was an animal when he was drinking. And, you know, I used to watch that. And for a long time, I spent a lot of my life trying to prove that I could drink and not turn into the animal that I used to see him turn into. And I never succeeded. And I nearly destroyed my life trying with that kind of competition with my dad. I'm one of three girls, and all three of us are alcoholics. I've got four kids. My daughter's a social cocaine user. Actually, you know, it's either serenity or senility that will eventually get you. And she's 50-something now, so she's sort of like leveled out, gone back to church, and she seems really happy. I have three sons. All three of them are in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to tell you, the world is a better place because those little bastards are sober. And this is their mother speaking, you know. My oldest grandson he's got about 9 months of sobriety in the program now. So I can tell you that my family has been given a second lease on life because of this program, because of you people, because of your willingness to get up at night and go put some drunk in the back of your car that's probably going to puke all over your seat. I've had that experience. It's exhilarating. And, you know, and take them wherever you need to go, to sit with them, to talk with them, buy them a cup of coffee, get them some help, whatever you need to do. I am so grateful to this program. I'm particularly grateful because I know the world is a better place because I'm sober. Let me see. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And it says we share in a general way. So, and having promised my sponsor that I wasn't going to modify anything, this puts me in a quandary, because if there's any of you who have virgin ears, get out. Just get out. You might as well, you know, go someplace else for tonight. Anyway, first time I got drunk, I was just a little kid. My father was having one of his wonderful parties, and my sister Ann and I, 5 and 6 years old, were serving drinks on these little trays, and I decided that I wanted to taste one of the drinks, and I did, and I liked it. Annie tasted hers. She liked it. So we emptied the trays, and we went back, and we told my dad, we can serve more. And so he filled up the trays, And with that, we walked straight up the hall, and instead of making the right turn into the living room, we walked straight into the closet, and the two of us drank everything on those trays. That was my first experience. Second experience, I was 14 years old, and that's the first time I ever saw the Al-Anon face. You know, the great stone face. What happened was I'd gone out with a couple of my friends, I was maybe a junior in high school, lied about my age because I was tall and I always got away with it. I was drinking some kind of orange juice and whatever, vodka, and started feeling sick, so I told my date I wanted to go home. Went home, walked into my bedroom and closed the door before I could turn on the light, and I got lost in my bedroom. And I had to throw up. So it turned into a total mess. And all I remember is I probably passed out. I came to, I had a little job at the New York Public Library on Saturday morning, so my mother came in to wake me up, and she walked in and she opened the door and the stench hit her and me sitting on the end of the bed looking at her, and she sort of like leaned into the doorway and gave me that look. But, you know, you know, any alcoholic will agree with me. What do you want? What do you want? You stand there looking at us, and we're supposed to do something. What? Because I never knew. I never knew what to do. I never knew what to say. It was just, they would look at you like everybody else knows, but I didn't know. I just didn't know. And, you know, somehow or other, it seemed important to me to mention that thing when I took my fifth step with my sponsor. And I told her about it. I had written it out, and I told her about it. And she said to me, "Franny, do you understand what was going on with your mom?" And I said, "Absolutely not. I don't have a clue. I don't even know why I'm talking about this." She said, "You know," she said, "from some of the things you've told me, your parents really loved each other." I said, "Yeah, they did. They adored each other." She said, "Well, isn't it interesting that your mother had to watch your father become an alcoholic and start on that downhill spiral? And now she walks in and here's her oldest daughter sitting there looking like him and smelling like him. And she knows that you've got that disease too." And I thought, wow. And I realized in that fifth step that the amends were about more than just, "Hey, gee, I'm sorry I caused you some inconvenience." That the amends were about making life-changing actions, and that I owed my mother a lot because I had really done some damage to her. To anybody that came within flailing distance got hurt. Anybody who got between me and a drink got hurt. And it wasn't that I wanted to hurt you. It was just you were in the way. And I had to have that drink. I had to do that thing. So anyway, I realized that. And what came out of that, now this is like all these things coming together. After I had taken that step with my sponsor and knowing that I had that responsibility, I wound up studying at Iowa State University, and I got a degree in cognitive psychology, which is research on the brain. It's the physiological aspects of psychology. And what happened was my mother, just when I was finishing up my degree, my mother got cancer of the brain. And one of the things that our research team was working on were a lot of these guys that were injured in the military. Head injuries, lots of head injuries in the military. They don't talk about it too much, but there's an awful lot. And a lot of people lose their ability to speak or their ability to work with words, or there's different cognitive processes that are really hurt. And what happened was she became aphasic. She, because of the brain, the tumor in the brain, she lost her ability to speak. And what happened was, when I took her down to L.A. General, because that's where she wanted to go for treatment, because it's one of the best oncology clinics in the world, The doctor knew about my research. We met across the examining table. And he said to me, I want you to be on our team. And I said, I don't think it would be... Actually, what my thought was, I can't do that. It's not ethical because it's a member of my own family. But what I said was, I don't think I can do that because I'm really not cleared for any kind of thing in California, but I will be unofficial. And so I was able to work with the doctors for a year until she died. And my mother died with the ability to speak and with the grace and dignity she wanted to die with. That's an amend. I don't know why I told that story in such detail, except that I think somebody here needed to hear it. The next time I drank, I got pregnant. You don't have to know the details. And the next time I drank, I got married. So, you know, I should have known I had a problem with booze, but if anybody said anything to me about it, I would have said, wait a minute. Anything worth doing is worth doing poorly in the beginning, and I'm just learning how. So just get out of my face and let me keep practicing, because I'm going to get this thing. And you know, the truth is I never got it. That guy that I got pregnant with, we got married, and that's how I wound up living in California. And we lived out in the valley, and I lived in one of those split-level traps, and I went to my girlfriend Shirley one time, and I said, Shirley, I had a kid. We had a kid. We had another kid. We bought a car. We had another kid. We bought a house. We had another kid. I don't know. By the time I was 26 or 27 years old, I had four kids, a house with a mortgage, and a car that he got into and went off to work every day in L.A. So I went to my girlfriend, Shirley. This is, I'd already learned about coffee clutches and stuff. And I said to her, is this all there is? And she said, Well, yeah, what else do you want? And I'm looking around. Now, I have a fantastic education, and I'm saying to myself, what is this, just a waste? What's the deal? So being a good Catholic kid, I went up to the church, and I asked the priest, not that I was getting hostile by then, but I said to the priest, you know, Father, I don't understand something. If the only thing you want from me is just to breed thousands of little Catholics, why do you guys bother educating girls? And he looked at me like I was clearly out of my mind, and he said, well, so you won't raise ignorant boys. Now, you have to have gray hair to understand that today. But I thanked him for his input, and I walked away from him, and what I did was I walked away from the Catholic Church. And what I didn't realize is, you know, Johnny Normal and his family out there, the church works for them, whatever church it is. You know, but we sit in here sometimes, and we really say, yeah, have you ever heard these idiots that get up and say, my name's Harry, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a recovered alcoholic and a recovered Catholic, and everybody goes, cut it out. You're only feeding somebody's resentment. Did you ever think of it that way? And that maybe that guy had something he needed to clear up? You know, it's not funny. I've seen people die behind that kind of stuff. So anyway, having thanked him for his input, I went home, and I just never entered a church again until much, much later. However, I do have to tell you this because I know it's going to make you feel good. I did get even. When I was living in Hawaii, I sponsored Mother Superior in Al-Anon, and she cleaned up the rectory. So all those priests wound up going to AA. I often feel that in an indirect way, and certainly not with good intentions, I was an agent of change for that parish in Hawaii. Anyway, what happened was I kept drinking, and, you know, I wasn't drinking a lot, but I started my drinking career on cream sherry. Can you believe it? That's not where it ended, but that's where it started. Cream sherry with my girlfriends, with these little biscuits, at these boring coffee clutches, everybody sitting around trying to be sophisticated. And it was childish and it was silly, but it was the best we could do because mostly what we were was just breeding all these little rugrats running around, and we just didn't have many people to talk to. So my husband and I bought some property down at the beach, and we moved down there. And I'm still bored, and I'm still restless, and still full of discontent. And I went down the beach one day, and I found my people. This was in 1962. And I swear that the Age of Aquarius started in 1962, about 300 feet south of the Redondo Beach Pier. Because I found some people down there, and the guys wore hip huggers and bell bottoms, and they had vests on with no shirts, and they had long hair, much longer than mine, and they had headbands, and they all just looked so healthy and happy, and the girls all looked like Russian peasants or some such thing. But the thing is, they were sitting around on the beach, and they didn't ask me the usual BS questions. They didn't ask me, oh, and where does your husband work? And, oh, what school do your children go to? And all the rest of that stuff that I just couldn't stand. Because it just put me in flames every time people started talking to me that way. And what these people wanted to talk about was what made the universe and where are we going to get the marijuana tonight? And, important questions about life. And they sat around. And I learned how to smoke marijuana with them, and I learned how to drink cheap wine. And, you know, I went home and I threw away all my little hats and all my little veils and my high-heeled shoes and my gloves. I don't know. I had a glove for every outfit, you know. And what happened was in 6 or 8 weeks, I'm down there hairy, happy, and hippie, too, you know. I stopped shaving my legs and under my arms. You know, I just really went native. And my husband was working for the L.A. Fire Department at the time, and he came to me and he said, what the hell is going on here? You know, one time he came to me and he was crying. Now, listen, the L.A. Fire Department doesn't raise any wimps. And I got to tell you, I could make that man cry whenever I felt like it. And he's standing there folding and unfolding a kitchen towel, because he came home and once more I'm drunk, you know. And he's saying to me, who are you? Where's the girl that I married? Where's the woman that's having my kids? Where's the lady that I want to grow old with? You're some kind of devil and I want you to get out of my life and I want you to send my wife back. Because you are not Franny. You are not my partner. You're some kind of piece of evil, and you're just shit, and I wish you would die. Years, he was folding and unfolding this paper, this towel. And years later, I went to him, and I said, this was when he finally started talking to me again. And I said, one of the kids got married or something, we were both there, and I said, you know, I have a question for you. He said, what? I said, remember the time that you told me to get out of your life, that I was a devil, and that you didn't want, he said, oh, yeah. I said, why were you folding and unfolding that kitchen towel? And he said, because if I had put it down, I would have strangled you right there. And I thought, he probably would have, and he probably gotten off. Because everybody knew. I mean, I was just a seething mass of destruction moving from one point to the other. When my 8-year-old son had his birthday, my oldest kid was a girl. Annie, she was 9, and Buddy was 8, and it was Buddy's birthday, and Ray was leaving for work that day, and he said to me, I'm coming home early, and I want to have a birthday party for Buddy. So he said, you get this house cleaned up while I'm gone, and pick up a cake, and we'll have a birthday party, because he wants a birthday party. I said, fine, no problem, no big deal. As soon as he left the house, I took the kids, we went down to the pier. I left the kids playing on the beach, and I went up to Tony's on the pier and sat there talking to my good friend, the bartender, and got thoroughly drunk. Found some idiot that was buying me drinks, and that was all I needed. So when my husband came home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm down there drunk to the gills, and I'm sitting there in the bar talking about the birthday party, but he walked into the house, and there was nobody there, and nothing was done, so he knew where to find me. So he came down and he dragged me off that bar stool and he punched me all the way down the pier. He punched me on this side, I went that way. He punched me on this side. I went that way. And he sort of like steered me down the pier. And the kids were standing down at the end of the pier. And, you know, I have had lots of moments of clarity. I don't know what people mean about a moment of clarity. I had lots of moments of clarity. I just chose to ignore them. And I had a moment, and I said to the kids, wait a minute. And I pulled some money out of my pocket, and I handed it to my daughter. And I said, look, I said, you guys buy some ice cream and walk home. We only lived two and a half blocks from the beach. By the time you get home, we'll pick up the birthday cake. We'll have the birthday party. You know, no, this was always what I said. No big deal. So he poured me into the car and we went home. And the next thing I remember is I'm on the phone and my daughter is saying, Mommy, please come back down here real quick. We don't know what happened, but Buddy was eating his ice cream cone and he finished it. And I don't know whether his hands were slippery or one of his friends pushed him, but he went over backwards into the water off the pier and we can't find him. And I know what it's like to get snapped into absolute cold operational sobriety with that kind of thing. When my husband, I gave the phone to him and Annie told him that, he shattered. I took him, I put him in the car, I drove us back down the beach, and I started running down the beach because I was going into that water after him. And the only person in the world who could have possibly stopped me was this big, fat Samoan friend of mine. And he pulled me, he grabbed me, he flipped me around, he pushed me down in the sand, kneeling, watching the water, and he leaned over and he said, Franny, don't you find him. And he held me there until one of my friends came walking out, carrying the body of my birthday kid. The next thing I remember is being up at South Bay Hospital, and the doctors are working on him in the emergency room, and I'm standing outside the emergency room, holding up this wall in the hall, and my husband is standing across, and he's looking at me, and he's holding up the other wall, and the two of us are standing there with our arms crossed, looking at each other and not saying anything. Now, that's a pretty strange situation. I mean, you've got a situation where you're waiting to find out whether a little kid is alive or dead. Even if we were strangers, we could have put our arms around each other and offered ourselves some consolation. But I had nothing for him for several years. And finally that year, he didn't care anymore. He had nothing for me. And the two of us stood there staring at each other, waiting to find out whether Buddy was alive or dead. That's what my drinking had done to that family. The doctor came out and he told us. And I got to tell you something. I know that there are no atheists in foxholes. Because when you got something like that, you're going to say, God, please, you know, don't let this baby die because I'm an incompetent human being. Don't take his life away because I'm a rotten mother. I mean, if there's any equity in this world at all, let me die and let him live. Nobody needs me. Nobody wants me. And this kid loves life. That's not the way it happened. We went home. And we were just in total silence. I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. I didn't cry. And the reason I didn't cry was because I didn't know I could cry. The kind of world that I had finally succeeded in building around myself, you didn't admit to any kind of weakness because the kind of people that I was running around with, I wasn't running around with the hairy, happy hippies. I was running around now with the guys that supplied them with the drugs. I was running around now with the guys that had guns that went out and did robberies. I had graduated. I was part of the bottom feeders by then. And I kept those two lives, my family and what I wanted to do, very, very separate, very compartmentalized. But in that life, in that kind of a jungle, you never let anybody know when you're weak, because if you let them know you're weak, you're going to get your throat cut and your money took. So I didn't cry. And my husband watched me going through the next 2 months like some kind of robot or automaton of some sort, feeding the kids, taking care of them, I guess. but no crying, no talking, no nothing. And see, what I realize now, looking back, I had just quietly gone crazy. And I was off in a world someplace where nobody else was. And the other thing that happened to me was I started drinking as much as I wanted. And this is important. I finally had reached a place in my life where nobody was going to tell me not to drink. What? In this time of emergency, in this time of tragedy, you're going to tell me not to drink? Get out of my way. So finally, nobody said anything. The husband didn't say anything. Nobody. And I was drinking as much as I wanted. And I got to tell you something. I was not drinking that much because of that tragedy. I was drinking that much because I was an alcoholic and I had found a situation I could milk. And I have to admit that whenever I tell this story. Because if any of you think that it was grief and despair that caused me to drink more, forget it. That's not why I drank that way. I drank that way because I finally had an opportunity to drink that way, and none of the external controls could interfere. I didn't have any internal controls. I only had external controls. My husband, my mother, you know, whoever was standing there looking at me, a boss occasionally, you know. But there were none in me. There was never anything in me that said, I shouldn't be doing this. The only thing that that little voice ever said to me was, how can we get some more? How can we get some more? That was my choir. So anyway, a couple of months later, Ray comes to me and he says, okay, Franny, here's the deal. That man had spent an awful lot of money trying to fix me in the course of our marriage. We had gone to psychologists, we had gone to marriage therapy, we've gone to counseling, we've gone to group therapy, all the stuff that was going on at the time. And he said, I've spoken to the doctors, I've spoken to the priests, I've spoken to the psychologists, I've spoken to everybody who has tried to help you, and they've all told me the same thing. So here it is. I'm divorcing you and I'm taking the kids away from you before you get the opportunity to murder another one of my kids. And I thought to myself, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. You really should. And then I got to thinking about it, and I realized, you know what? I don't want to let go of these kids. Because as much as I claimed there was absolutely nothing for me to live for, there was a connection between me and my kids. You know, it was weird at best, but it was there. And I never thought of their welfare. I only thought of, I'm not letting go of these kids. So I went out and I interviewed lawyers, and I found a lawyer who smelled like a newcomer, which was exactly what I wanted. I interviewed him. I hired him. I seduced him, and I blackmailed him so that he was forced to provide false witnesses in a court of law. There were people who came to that, you know, this was when divorces were antagonistic. None of this friendly conciliation stuff. These were to the death. And he provided these witnesses that, oh, you know, she's not a good wife, we know that, but she's a wonderful mother. She's always with these children and blah, 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 blah. I had no idea who these people were as they marched in and out of the courtroom. And he simply overwhelmed my husband's argument with the number of people that he had gotten to stand up there and lie. So, I got the kids. I went around for a long time telling everybody how hip, slick, and cool I was because I got those kids. I thought I was really hip, slick, and cool. And it wasn't until much, much later on that I realized that the reason that God left those kids with me was because they needed to watch me hit my bottom and get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, so then when their turn came, they would know where to go, which they did. So for years, I thought I was hip, sick, and cool. And the only thing I want to warn you about is if you've gone through something in your life, certainly I hope to God, not like my experiences, but if you've gone through something where you think you know what's going on, Trust me, you probably don't until you're years down the line. So anyway, now I had the kids, and with this keen intellect and this wonderful education, I had to go find a job and start supporting them. And I went out, and in a week, I found a perfect job, and I wound up being a barmaid in a beer bar on Pacific Coast Highway. And what happened was I was daytime bartender, so that made me the manager. And that's what I used to tell people. And I was cleaning up the bar one day, and you're doing pretty good. Made a lot of money, learned how to turn tricks in the back room, turned into a pool shark, made money on the pool table, dealing drugs, of course. Everybody else is drinking beer in this poor little beer bar, and I'm drinking scotch and coffee because I didn't drink beer. I used to just say I don't drink, but I'd be sucking up the scotch and the coffee while everybody else is drinking beer. Anyway, one day I'm wiping down the bar, and this guy comes slithering in. Now, I don't know about the rest of you ladies, but I am not going to brag about my ability to choose good men. Not at all. So this guy, he danced the way I did. He shot pool the way I did. He stayed up 3 and 4 days at a time like I did. He was a liar, cheat, and a thief like I was. And he wound up stealing a credit card and asking me to go to Las Vegas and get married. And God, when you get an offer like that, what can you say? You know? So we did. We came to Las Vegas and we got married. 10 months later, I had another kid. And when that baby was 6 months old, that man that I had carefully chosen to be my partner in life, right? He's standing in the doorway looking at me with those black eyes, and he's saying, I can't take this game. I'm gone. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. I got another kid. Of course, this is not all conscious, but I'm that much further into my disease. I got another kid. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to be sole support anymore. And I knew if he wasn't living there, he was not the most responsible of people, and forget about paying child support. Never got a dime of child support from that guy. But got the best kid in the world, so I figure it's fair. Anyway, I'm saying, what can I do to save this sick situation? And I remembered that my mother used to call Alcoholics Anonymous on my father. And they used to come to the door. Tall, good-looking guys, clean with the hats and the overcoats. You know, this is New York. And they would come in and they would have a cup of tea and she would cry. And, you know, there was real tea and sympathy going on here. And by God, I needed a little tea and sympathy. So I figured, okay. As an aside, though, my father always got away just before they got there. He never got to meet any of these nice gentlemen. So anyway, I figured, okay, I'm going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got on the phone, and I couldn't dial because I was drunk. And let's save some time here. From now on, anything I tell you I did, I was drunk, okay? Let's just assume I was drunk, okay? So we don't have to waste 2 or 3 seconds every time. Anyway, what happened was I called them up, and I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't like dealing with clerks. So I said to him, I want to talk to the boss. And this guy must have been a newcomer. Later on, I think somebody told me that he was, but he turned around, he held the phone, and he said, hey, there's a lady on the phone, and she wants to talk to the boss. And the next thing I hear is, give me that. No, you give me that phone. No, you give me that, you know. And they're fighting for the damn phone. And finally, the biggest and strongest obviously got it. And he gets on the phone, and he says, hello, my name is Harry, and I'm an alcoholic, and how can I help you? So I figured, okay. So I laid out my story, and he said, well, I have to tell you. No, I said, I want to talk to the boss. And he said, our higher power is not available to talk to you on the phone at this moment. But he says, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, he said, I can discuss the disease or the recovery therefrom. May I help you? That's the way he put it. And I thought, okay, it sounds like I got a vice president. This should be all right. So I started laying the story out, and I started telling him all my woes and about what he did and blah, 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 blah. And you know what this guy came to pretty quick was that, yeah, maybe we're talking about that drunk fool out there, but we got a drunk fool right here we should be paying attention to. So he asked me to come up to the meeting that night, and he offered to send a car for me. I had not had a car pick me up in a long time. And I thought he was making a move on my bones. I did. And I was very nice to him. And, well, you know, I mean, I love my husband, but a girl's got to look out for herself, you know. And this guy may be worth some attention. Who knew, you know? So anyway, I talked to him for a while, and he offered to send the car, and I wanted him to think well of me, so I told him, no, you don't have to send the car. I have a car. You just tell me where to go. So he told me where to go. I had 25 cents, and I can tell you that in 1967, a gallon of gasoline cost 25 cents because I took my last quarter and I put it in the gasoline tank to get to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was driving this big, ugly old beater that just ate gasoline like you wouldn't believe. But anyway, I did use my last quarter for that, and I want to tell you how I got ready for my first AA meeting. I put on my 79-cent Zoris from Zodi's. I had camel-colored corduroy hip huggers, bell-bottoms. Actually, there was a party at my house, and somebody had left them on the back lawn. I don't know who owned them, but I washed them, and they fit me, and that made them mine. I had a man's shirt that I had gotten from Goodwill with a button missing here that I pinned carefully from the inside, you know, for propriety. I had a camel-colored sweater that I'd stolen from Goodwill because I couldn't afford to buy it. I had a broken nose and two black eyes from the argument the night before. I don't know, we saw something on TV and it was a political discussion and it deteriorated. This was in 1967, and the Afro did not come out until 1975. But I had an Afro because it's real easy for my hair, if I don't wash it, to just keep getting bigger. And I hadn't taken a shower or washed my hair in a long time. And I got in that car, spent that last 25 cents, warmed up to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and walked into the Manhattan Beach Club and looked around and wondered if you were going to live up to my expectations. And there was this guy up there, and he would, you notice how all the important guys hang around the podium? Well, they do up where we are. Anyway, he saw me come in, and he signaled me to come on over, and they put me in a seat right in the front. And this was when they gave you coffee mugs with coffee and sometimes even cups and saucers. And they sat me in the front, and this guy named Frank P. got up, and he talked about the silliest stuff I'd heard before or since. And he talked about the mailman running away with the wife and the house burning down. And, God, it was just, you know, I laughed. And the first thing I noticed about you is you laughed the same time I did. Now, I am an inappropriate human being. And the fact that I was sitting in a room full of people who laughed the same time I did, my response was, these people are sick. Which was okay. I was okay with sick. It didn't bother me a bit. And then he said, okay. He said, well, enough of that. Now we're going to have questions and answers. Because what they had done was they had snookered me into going to the beginner's meeting. The 7 o'clock beginner's meeting on Friday night. So when he said we're going to have questions from the audience now, I figured his shills were going to jump in and, you know, with the preset questions. I said, no way. And I got my hand right up. I said, hey, how do I get my old man to stop beating me? Because this was the easiest and clearest way I could tell you I was not in that audience because of my own actions. I was a simple victim of circumstances, and it was him. I was pointing at him. And Frank said, gee, he said, you know, I haven't had anybody's old man beat me up since I got sober. But I'm gonna get Indian Jeannie up out of the audience here, and I want Jeannie to share her experience, strength, and hope with this lady. So he stepped back, and Jeannie stepped up to the podium, and she says, my name's Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic. And any son of a bitch that lays a hand on me now that I'm sober is going to get a knife right in the gut. And I said, hot dog, these people have the answers. And I stayed for that meeting, and I stayed for the 8:30 meeting, and I stayed for the midnight wrist slashers meeting. You know, that's the meeting they always have candles at. And I wondered about that, and it's so that you don't have to watch grown men cry. Because that's the meeting that you go to. You know, your sponsors are always these old fogies, so, you know, they go home and go to bed after the 8:30 meeting. So that means you can go to the 12 o'clock meeting, and you can sit around and talk with your friends about the relationship your sponsor told you not to get into. You know, so that's what the midnight meeting was for. And that's where I don't know how many times I saw these guys. They thought they were bringing these little goldfish home for pets, and what they were carrying home in the little plastic bag was baby barracudas. You know, and I'm not putting it on the guys. The women did the same thing, you know. But anyway, that's all just part of staying sober and going to midnight meetings. You learn all that. So anyway, I stayed for all those meetings, and they poured me out of there. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now. I'm pretty safe. The bars are closed. So I go home, and I went in my kitchen. I'm still drunk. And I went, and I found the biggest knife that I had, and I cleaned it, and I wiped it off, and I tried it, and I polished it, and I put it right there on the counter so that when he came home, I could introduce his ass to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did, and I had that man backed up in the corner with the knife under his throat, and I'm going, bleh, 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 I'm a child of God, bleh, 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 bleh. Hey, hey, and, bleh, 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 bleh. And he didn't know what the heck was coming off. And I pulled the knife back, you know, get a little feedback, and he split. So I figured, okay, no problem. It's fine by me, because he was, I had the whole weekend to go to meetings. And what happened was, you know, there are fools in this program. Fools. And because I was the kind of person I was quick to spot the people who would tell me what I wanted to hear. And I used to hang around with the old boys, and they would say things like, well, that's okay, girlie. You go find the people that, you know, you're comfortable with. You find the people you identify with. So the people I identified with were the people that didn't go to the meetings. They were the people that sat outside the club popping their fingers and dragging their heels and saying, wow, this is cool, huh? Yeah, cool. But not knowing anything about it. And my little group were the ones that took turns going out, getting drunk, getting killed, coming back sometimes, not coming back. There was another thing. You're only as sick as your secrets. And see, the thing I never told anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous was I was a speed freak. I went on Benzedrine when I was 13 years old. Sailed through high school, never shut up. All right, got skinny enough to get pregnant, got married. Then I had the kids, so I was always either on Dexedrine or Dexamil before, during the pregnancy or after the pregnancy, because everybody was trying to look like Doris Day. So I was always on something speed. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this was right about the time, this was 67 to 70, and they were all saying, and we will not talk about drugs. So I said, okay, I won't. So I never told anybody that I had a problem with speed. And what happened was I couldn't get sober. Even though I quit drinking, I couldn't stay sober for any length of time because I was still on speed. And I was getting more and more miserable, hanging around AA, coming to meetings drunk, coming to meetings sober, come to meetings drunk, coming to meetings sober. Coming to meetings drunk, drunk, drunk. By the end of the 3 years, I was more drunk than sober, but I had never gotten away from meetings. The only thing is that when they picked me up, when they 12-stepped me, they didn't try to talk to me about program. when they took me to the meetings, they would just drop me off in the half measures room and nobody would sit there and talk to me. You know, the only thing that they did, I would call them up because I didn't have a car anymore. You know, if you're the kind of person that's going to argue about all these important things keeping you from going to meetings, keep doing it. Eventually they will all disappear and you won't have anything between you and the Alcoholics Anonymous you need to get to. You know, I never argue with newcomers if they say, oh, I'm just so busy, I can't move up. Fine, you know, because I know you're going to destroy it. You're going to ruin it. It will be removed from your life. Don't worry, all obstacles will be removed eventually. And you have either death or sobriety. It's a very clean decision. So anyway, that's basically where I was. And I hated everybody there. When you can't have something that you really, really want, you hate it. You learn to hate it. And I learned to hate the people in Alcoholics Anonymous because they were so happy. I would sit there in that half measures room and I'd hear them laughing upstairs at the meeting or coming down and laughing and talking about going for coffee or doing something like that. And nobody ever asked me to go anywhere with them. You know, they used to say, at the best, I would get, hey, Franny, the meeting's starting. Come on upstairs. Or, okay, Franny, the meeting's over. Go on downstairs. Well, that's what I got because that's all I wanted. And there was this lady. It was the Sunday night young people's meeting. I used to go to it. And I hated her because she was surrounded by people who laughed, who had a good time, who used to get together and go and do things. They went to the movies on Friday night. They had just gone down to see hair. They were really having fun. And she's standing alone in the middle of the floor while they're clearing up after the meeting, just happened to be alone right at that moment. And I went over to her and I said, Dottie. She said, yeah, Franny, because, you know, everybody knew me. I was the club loser. She said, yeah, Franny, what do you want? And I said, I was going to tell that woman what I thought of her. I was going to confront her for the phony I felt she was. And I opened my mouth and I said, will you be my sponsor? And I don't know where that came from, but she looked at me and she said, God, Franny, I don't know, you're a loser. And I did the thing that saved my life. I looked her right in those eyes and I took a deep breath and I said the word that I hadn't said in 15 years. I said, please. And what happened to me was that in asking that woman to come into my life as my sponsor, I had to step out of being the center of my own universe. And in stepping out of being the center of my own universe, I made space for God. And without anybody's permission, he came in along with her. She said, well, okay. She put her hand out. One of her lieutenants gave her a directory, and she said, these are the meetings I go to. I'll see you there. And she handed me this little book. And I thought, okay, I got a sponsor, but I don't know what to do with her. So I stayed away from her very carefully because I just hadn't figured it out yet. See, I had to figure it out. And what happened was I didn't go near her, but I went around misquoting her a lot. And she told me, she said, I don't want a thing that you have. I am not going to call you. If you want what I have, you call me. She said, because I'm sure as hell not going to chase you. So I figured, good, I was safe. And you know what happened? 7 o'clock, maybe even 6:45, one morning, the phone rings by my bed, and I pick it up, and I go, hello? And she says, hi. She says, how are you? I said, oh, I'm fine, thank you. And she said, you're such a liar. She said, tell me, have you quit taking speed yet? How did she know? I never told anybody about that. That was the big secret. And she said, have you quit? And I said, yes. She said, good. When did you quit? And I went, this morning. She said, okay. She said, come on over to my house and start hanging out. Watch what these people do and find out how to do sober because you don't know how to do sober. So I went over to her house and I found out that I had stepped into a den of step Nazis. And these people were working the steps. And they were not interested in me. They were interested in my sobriety. They weren't interested in taking me out. They were interested in taking me to a meeting. They weren't interested in buying my attention. They were interested in buying me a meal before the meeting. And you know what happened? I started hanging around with people that actually were enjoying life, and I started learning how. And when I had 9 months of sobriety, this little Indian broad that was just a big old accident looking for a place to happen, I'd been watching her, came up to me and she said, "Franny, I've talked to so many people and they don't want to be my sponsor and they all tell me to come talk to you." Well, I knew why, you know. So I said, "Wait a minute, Becky, look, you stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay." We were at a meeting, and I ran over to my sponsor, who was at the meeting, and I said, "Dottie, Becky just asked me to be her sponsor. What should I do?" She said, "Franny," she said, "go ahead," she said, "and stay one step ahead of her. She'll never know the difference." So that's when I started 9 months sobriety. I started sponsoring that girl, and I have sponsored, I'll tell you, I've heard an awful lot of fifth steps, you know, and I have sponsored a lot of women that filled me with admiration for their courage, their persistence, their dignity, their integrity, their responsibility, all the words I couldn't even spell. And these are the people who taught me. It's not the other way around. Because what happens when you got a crew of those sharp-eyed little bitches watching you, and by God, they are keen, you know? They watch every move you make, and you got to sit up straight at the meetings, and you got to talk at the meetings, and you got to make some sense, and you better make at least 3 references to the big book and 2 references to the steps. You got to know what you're talking about, baby, when you sponsor these women. And what happened was I learned. 2 minutes to tell you this. I was unemployed and unemployable, and what happened was I went back to school. I told you about getting the degree in psychology. But I went to my husband one time and I said, "You know, Carter," I said, "you know, I like all this stuff, but the truth of the matter is the thing I really wanted to do, I've always wanted to work in the theater. I just love theater." And he said to me, "Well, you know, whose permission are you waiting for?" Only from an alcoholic. Whose permission are you waiting for? So I went down and I got myself enrolled in school. I got a degree in theater. I got my master's in theater. And I wound up putting a program for teaching stagecraft in the toughest high school in the United States, Compton High School, right outside of Los Angeles. And I am so lily white, you know. And I didn't know if it was going to work. I didn't know if it was going to be accepted. But what happened was I treated those kids with dignity and respect, and they gave me the same. And also, I happened to have the opportunity to 12-step a couple of them. And I got some of them were working for Warner Grand. Some of them were working for the big production studios, which are all in the area. They're making some money. And but the thing is, in the classroom one time, we were sitting there, and you can't play hooky in that school because it's a closed school with the fences go in and the armed cops and cars are on the campus. So you can't, you know, you just can't get over the fence. They'll shoot you. So what happened was this girl brought one of her boyfriends to the class, and he was going to test me out. So he was sitting there, and he had his feet up on the desk, and he's just watching me like, "All right, what are you going to show me?" And 2 of my students walked up to him and knocked his feet off the desk, Javier and Alex. And they leaned over to them and they said, "Hey, Jefe, we don't act like that in this classroom. We're professionals. You want to act like that, go someplace else." And I didn't do a thing. I just turned around and kept writing on the board because I didn't know what the hell. They handled it fine as far as I was concerned. But, you know, I've had those experiences and that's part of my life. And I'm still sponsoring people. And I'll tell you something. You want to get well? You really want to work on your program, you want to live a long time, you want to be 72 years old and getting in a car and driving up here to talk at a meeting where you didn't know anybody and now everybody's your friend, sponsor somebody. Thank you.